in the state.
Presentation mode is now disabled.
In 1915 alone. Most of these children come from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador in recent years. The usual explanation is to escape gang violence, abuse, and exploitation. These children are often trying to escape extreme poverty, trying to reunite with a family member, seeking an education or educational opportunities. Generally, these children arrive in the U.S. without proper entry papers or have come in and have expired papers. Most have been placed by Health and Human Services with a caregiver without the benefit of a home study and no caseworker assigned to provide services. Remember that undocumented is a status and not a crime. Also, the INS is now the U.S. Citizenship Immigration Services. Even though these are state proceedings, a deportation action may still occur. Amanda Harrell was going to go over the issues related to the legal background, then Dixie Ellis is going to address some definitions, the benefits, the eligibility, and the qualifying juvenile order. And then finally, Troy Farquhar will address the case law and address the issues confronting the Florida Supreme Court in its review of a pending fourth DCA case and also a third DCA case. So I'm going to turn it over to Amanda.
Hello, everyone. I'm going to be focusing on unaccompanied children and what happens to them when they enter the U.S., though we recognize children don't have to be unaccompanied to be eligible for special immigrant juvenile status. Children who come into the U.S. from other countries without a guardian are called unaccompanied alien children. They enter the U.S. immigration system when they are apprehended by the Department of Homeland Security. Subsidiary agencies of the Department of Homeland Security include Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the U.S. Coast Guard. The Office of Border Patrol, a division of Customs and Border Protection, apprehends most of the children when they try to cross the border from Mexico to the U.S. Special rules apply to children who come from our contiguous countries, Mexico and Canada. Most are returned immediately through a process called, quote, voluntary return. Children from other countries who are apprehended are taken to a temporary Department of Homeland Security detention facility for processing. There they are interviewed by a Customs and Border Protection officer or an Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer, and then released to a family member or transferred to another facility overseen by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Removal proceedings can be initiated immediately by the Department of Homeland Security. Previously, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service held children in its custody and also acted as prosecutor for violating immigration laws. There was a conflict of interest inherent in playing the role of caregiver and prosecutor, and many human rights organizations and political groups lobbied for the care and custody of unaccompanied children to be transferred to another agency. This conflict was resolved when Congress passed the Homeland Security Act of 2002, which transferred the care and custody of unaccompanied children to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. A movement to improve detention conditions began even before 2002. In 1997, a class action lawsuit called Flores versus Meese resulted in a settlement that required the release of children to an approved sponsor without unnecessary delay, obligated the INS to place children in the least restrictive setting appropriate to their age and special needs, and implemented standards for care and treatment of children in immigration detention. The terms of the Flores settlement apply today and reflect, or at least aspire to, a change from an adult detention model to a child welfare-based model of care. Additional efforts to reform the law for unaccompanied children led to the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008, which expanded the responsibilities of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and required that each child must be placed promptly into the least restrictive setting that is in the best interest of the child. And it also mandated that children be allowed to retain legal counsel and petition for the right to stay in the U.S. at an immigration hearing. Within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Resettlement is currently responsible for providing care to children referred by immigration authorities. The majority of the children are cared for through a network of state-licensed Office of Refugee Resettlement-funded care providers. The average length of stay for children in an Office of Refugee Resettlement program in 2015 was 34 days. If a family member or other acceptable caregiver for the child is located, the Office of Refugee Resettlement will release the child into that person's care. So most of the children in Office of Refugee Resettlement custody receive care through a network of local providers, which include private and nonprofit organizations. In my slides, there is a link to the state of Florida programs and services that are available, so you might click on that to see what's available locally. All of these facilities must provide children with classroom education, health care, socialization, recreation activities, vocational training, mental health services, case management. They must also assist with family reunification when possible. So the next question is, how can an unaccompanied child stay in the U.S. legally? I will turn it over to Dixie to answer that question.
One of the options for an unaccompanied child in the United States to remain in the United States would be to become a special immigrant, receive special immigrant juvenile status, and the eligibility, the benefits for that child who received this status are many. Not only are they able to work if they are able to receive a work permit, they can obtain a driver's license. They can then travel outside of the state after obtaining that residency.
Okay.
They can receive certain forms of public aid. After July 1st of 2016, they can receive Medicaid now without the waiting period. They can receive financial educational loans and other financial aid. Upon receiving the special immigrant juvenile status, they can then apply for citizenship after turning 18 and once they've had residency for 5 years. However, those children who receive the special immigrant juvenile status, they can't submit an application to assist their parents to receive the immigration status. For either parent, even if any findings any findings of abuse or neglect or abandonment only apply to one parent, neither parent would be able to, that child wouldn't be able to assist either parent. There is some question, however, after they've received their citizenship, they may be able to assist in other ways. Now, these eligibility requirements have been defined by the Immigration and Naturalization Act and its subsequent amendments, so it is important to stay up on the immigration law in these cases. A quick assist is to always drop by the Health and Human Services online, U.S. Citizenship online. Currently, those requirements are the applicant or whoever is applying for that child must be under 21 years of age, unmarried, located within the United States, with a qualifying juvenile order. Now, before all of this is done, the question of consent from Health and Human Services must be raised. Now, this is rarely needed. If custody or placement won't be altered, from the placement chosen by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or if the juvenile has already been released from their custody, At that time, specific consent isn't needed. However, if that child is still in custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or a change of that placement is necessary, then there is a link on the slide to get the request for specific consent for juvenile court jurisdiction from the ORR. And then at that point, that is filled out and it's emailed to Health and Human Services. Now, within 2 days of that email, notification should be received that the request was received, and then supposedly a decision is granted within 30 days. Now, under 21, prior to the passage of the victims of TVPRA 2008, federal adjudication of special immigrant juvenile status had to be completed before the child turned 21, otherwise they were ineligible. Pardon me. After its passage, the applicant can now be under 21 solely at the time of filing. It's okay now if they turn 21 before the determination. So it's only at the time of filing of the petition for special immigrant status with the feds that they have to be under 21. Now, however, that is, of course, dependent on dependency must be established according to the state jurisdiction and, in, of course, Florida 18. However, please note that this jurisdiction, Florida 39.5075, subsection 6, I believe, states that the court is allowed to retain jurisdiction over that child until the age of 22 or until the petition with the feds has been considered. Now, the next requirement is that that child remain unmarried. Now, most of our children, of course, that's not going to be an issue. However, depending on the home country and the circumstances prior to their entering the United States, proof of marital status may be required. Divorce, death of a spouse, annulment aren't a barrier to this eligibility. However, the applicant must remain unmarried until they become a permanent resident or the status can be automatically revoked at that time. Now, the qualifying juvenile orders, these orders can stem from a variety of situations. Our focus, of course, is dependency. However, these orders can also stem from paternity, custody, adoption, guardianship, and even delinquency cases. Now, these orders, juvenile court systems must include findings that the child is either dependent on the court or has been placed with, of course, a state agency, private agency, or a private person. Now, the child cannot be reunited. There must not be a viable reunification with one or both parents because of abuse, abandonment, and neglect. Now, TVPRA 2008 does allow for those situations where children who were abused, abandoned, or neglected by one parent and they've been placed with a non-offending parent, they can still be eligible for this status. Now, it also must not be in the child's best interest to be returned to their home country. The evidence supporting this position can include things such as civil unrest in that particular country, lack of access to necessary medical, psychiatric care, perhaps deteriorated conditions of the home country, the acculturation of the child to the United States, any ties to siblings, any risk of harm to the child if they're returned to the home country, such as the drug cartels or perhaps laws against females. Any and all relevant factors may be considered and should be. And also, Florida, under Florida statute, the ruling of the court should include findings as to the express wishes of that child, if able, and any appropriate circumstances that would affect the best interest of that child. Now, after Florida, after the courts make specific findings of eligibility, Florida requires that after the specific findings are made, they should be filed, a petition with the feds should be filed within 60 days. The Florida also requires that these children who remain in the dependency jurisdiction, review hearings should be done every so often to check on the status of the petition. And again, jurisdiction will terminate on a final federal decision, but no later than the child's 22nd birthday. All right, now one of the important things to remember is that this special immigrant juvenile status is designed for those children who are at risk of abuse, neglect, abandonment. So that particular order is very important. Florida courts aren't simply a rubber stamp. There must be viable reasons.
Let's talk about the case. Something else you need to add, Mandy?
Listed in the PowerPoint are some other forms of legal relief besides special immigrant juvenile status that might be available to some of our children, so I just encourage all of you to take a look at that in the PowerPoint, but I'm not going to go through it for you today. I believe Troy will pick up next with some case law information on this subject.
All right, good afternoon. Happy Friday. This is Troy Farquhar. I thought that I would go through some cases in Florida that talk about special immigrant juvenile status. And there's a handout that was included in the email sent out, the briefs of these cases, and they're chronological because there's been some evolution in the way that the appellate courts are viewing these cases, and I would characterize it as a little bit more pessimistic than it was 10 years ago. And so the first case, pessimistic as in upholding denials of dependency petitions. So the first case that I've included in the materials is FLM versus DCF out of the 4th District in 2005. The facts of that case was that a 14-year-old made his way to Florida from Guatemala. He was orphaned and living with the parents of a girlfriend with whom he had fathered a child. A private dependency petition was filed, and the trial was held up for various reasons up until a couple months prior to the child's 18th birthday. DCF took no position, and there was no services being sought from the state. The trial court denied the petition, and on appeal, the issues were, A, whether the court had jurisdiction, and then, B, whether the child was actually dependent. The jurisdictional issue was settled in that the court had jurisdiction if the child was not in actual constructive or was not in actual or constructive possession of at the time, which was at the time was the Attorney General. Now it's Health and Human Services. And then also the court found that the child was dependent because the child had no parents or legal guardian in the state of Florida to provide for him. He was residing with his girlfriend's parents, who had no legal obligation to provide for him. Also in the court's analysis, the court pointed out that the child's motivation in filing the dependency petition was irrelevant because it stood out that the child was basically filing the petition to obtain the special immigrant juvenile status. One of the quotes from that case that I thought was interesting was that essentially during the appellate level, it was admitted by a DCF that the child was dependent, and the DCF made a public policy argument that state courts and department resources should not be utilized simply to gain a favorable immigration status for a child who is not in any real danger or going without the necessities of life. The appellate court found that this argument was unavailing and basically took the position that if the child qualified as being dependent, the motivations of the child for filing the petition were irrelevant. So that's sort of the starting point. The next case I've cited is out of the 5th DCA, LT versus DCF. It's a case in 2010. And in this case, the child immigrated from Haiti and was picked up by the Department of Homeland Security and released to his uncle. The child, a private dependency petition was filed, and the trial court dismissed the dependency petition. The issues in that case were whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction again, and there were some notice issues that DCF raised on appeal. Also, an issue at the trial court, at the appellate court level, was whether the appeal was moot, given that the child was, by the time the appeal went up on appeal, the child was over the age of 18. Again, the jurisdictional issue was basically not acknowledged by the appellate court because it wasn't raised in the lower court, but the appellate court did again acknowledge that as long as the child is not in actual constructive custody at the time the Attorney General, then the trial court had jurisdiction. But as far as the question as to whether the case was moot, the appellate court said the case is not moot because the effect of the denial of the dependency is that the child is deprived of a legal basis to regularize his immigration status. So again, that just sort of confirms that the motivations for filing the dependency petition should be irrelevant. So fast forward to 2015, first DCA case, Henry YB, which is actually out of Alachua County. The facts of that case was that there was a private dependency petition filed on behalf of a child of Honduran descent who illegally immigrated. The facts adduced at trial was that YB, the child, had been abused in Honduras by his parents, and he crossed the U.S.-Mexico border by himself and was picked up by, quote-unquote, authorities, who who contacted his uncle. It was found that the express purpose of the dependency petition was to allow the child to apply for special parent status. And the trial court dismissed the petition because it does not allege that YV has been abused, abandoned, or neglected while in Florida, or that he faces imminent risk of harm. A second ground of dismissal was that the trial court concluded that the petition was an attempt to circumvent federal immigration laws and suggested that it lacked jurisdiction over the case. So issues on appeal were, one, whether the child was dependent, and then, two, again, whether the express intent of the petitioner to obtain this status is a factor in determining whether the child is dependent, and then finally whether the court had jurisdiction. So the rule out of that case was that the appellate court said that Chapter 39 is to be liberally construed. There are no provisions in the chapter that require the events giving rise to the grounds for dependency to occur in Florida, and the grounds alleged in the petition do not require that the child be at imminent risk. They go on to say the statutory scheme currently in place provides a pathway to lawful permanent residency for undocumented children who have been abused, abandoned, and neglected. So that is to say that the child's intent for filing the dependency petition is not relevant. And finally, they also say that the court has jurisdiction to adjudicate a child dependent, but only if the child is not in the custody of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So part of the holding of that case, the court stated that while the laws may be vulnerable to misuse, the mere acknowledgement that a dependency petition, that the petitioner intends to seek the protections of special immigrant juvenile status does not render the petition invalid. It goes on to note that the Florida legislature has specifically contemplated Florida's participation in the process of a juvenile obtaining SIJ status by facilitating in the law that the community-based care agency responsible for the care of the juvenile must consider whether the child may be eligible for SIJ status and, if qualified, petition the court for an order finding the child to qualify for SIJ status. So the legislature actually contemplated that the dependency courts would be used for that purpose. And the case was eventually reversed for further proceedings because there was a prima facie case laid out in the dependency petition. Of note, in this case, the child was residing with an uncle, but the court found that the uncle had no legal obligation to provide for the child, and so the child could be dependent based on their not being caregivers for him. So that case is kind of note because later on we'll see that the courts would characterize it, the courts begin to strain to find legal caregivers for kids that would render their petitions, that would warrant the petitions being denied. But in this YV case, the child was residing with an uncle, and the court found that the uncle had no legal obligation to provide for the child, so the child was dependent. So also in 2015, I cited a case out of the 3rd District. It's in the interest of KBLV. Basically, this case finds that allegations in a dependency petition that are very remote in time may not qualify the child as being dependent. In that case, a child who is 17 years old petitioned for an order adjudicating dependent based on allegations of abandonment by his father in 2003 while the child was residing in Honduras. So then the child comes to the United States and he's residing with his mother in Florida and files this dependency petition. The trial court found that the child, KBLV, may have been abandoned by his father in 2003, but the abandonment was too remote in time to qualify the child as dependent. And the child was also living with his mother, and there was no indication that the child was at any kind of risk residing with his mother. DCF took the position in that case that due to the remoteness of the abandonment, there's an issue of lack of harm or lack of imminent risk of harm, imminency being the key issue. So the case goes up on appeal. The issue was whether or not there's an imminency requirement to find the child dependent, and also whether the threat of deportation may serve as a factor to a finding of dependency. So I would say the rules out of that case, the trial court's holding was affirmed that there is no imminency. Let me just state the rule. There is no imminency requirement for a finding of abuse within the statute. However, in the absence of continuing threat of harm, incidences of alleged abuse found too remote in time will generally not support a dependency adjudication. So that's right. In this case, the appellate court did uphold the trial court. And also, the threat of deportation may be a factor in determining dependency. However, it may not be the sole basis of adjudication. The court states the purpose of Chapter 39 is to ensure that children under its jurisdiction are cared for in a safe and secure environment. Judge Shepard wrote the opinion in this case. He raises some other issues that he points out in later cases that I've cited. Judge Shepard states that in all probability, these cases are not even justiciable and that there is no real case or controversy for consideration in the court. And notes that although dependency is a prerequisite to the SIJ designation, these are really but advisory opinions, and anything the court rules is subject to review and reconsideration by Homeland Security. There's another case that issued on the same day from the same circuit, and Judge Shepard notes refers to that case in this KDLB ruling. He states that the petitioners are asking the court to read a single subsection of Florida dependency law in isolation and independent from the remainder of the chapter, and that this is a no-no, in that the whole text canon requires that the judicial interpreter to consider the entire text in view of its structure and of the physical and logical relations of its parts. So that case and the companion case of BYGM, basically same facts, 17-year-old seeking adjudication of dependency based on abandonment of a single parent while the petitioner was residing with the other parent in the United States. So in the BYGM case, the court also upheld the denial of a dependency petition and states that it's understood that the child in this case filed her petition to secure the immigration status, and that she did not file the petition in order to seek relief from abuse, abandonment, or neglect. There is, however, simply no basis for a declaration of dependency under these circumstances, where there is neither substantial risk of imminent abuse, abandonment, or neglect, nor the absence of a parent or legal custodian incapable of providing supervision and care. So my editorial is that it appears that up until recently, these petitions were sort of given the benefit of the doubt, and if it met the strict letter of the law, the petitions would be granted or the appellate court would overturn. But now the courts are sort of taking a more skeptical view of these cases, and unless there's actually some showing of imminent risk or abandonment or neglect, that it's likely that denial of the petition would be upheld. Judge Shepard also, in this case, really reamed DCF because they were not participating in the lower court proceedings oftentimes, but were standing mute, and that goes along with his whole finding in the companion case that these petitions are basically for advisory purposes and that there's really no justiciable issues. One of the quotes from the case is that DCF may find it uncomfortable to oppose a petition for dependency that will help a child obtain legal immigration status. It may consider these cases to be too sensitive for its taste. However, as the agency charged with protecting children and families, DCF should have a keen interest in the outcomes of these cases and how we interpret the applicable law. He states that Chapter 39 is to provide protection for those children who, with their families, he states that it's a stretch, that these cases are attempting to stretch Chapter 39 and the Special Immigrant Juvenile Status Statute beyond their respective purposes. The purpose of SIJS is a narrow one, and that's to provide protection to those children who, with their families, entered the United States illegally and who are in danger of being deported along with abusive or neglected parents, or whose parents have abandoned them in the United States. The next case out of the fourth DCA, which I believe is one of the ones that Tom was referring to as being on appeal in the Supreme Court, is OICL versus DCF. In this case, it was similar facts. A 17-year-old applied for or filed a private dependency petition 2.5 months before his 18th birthday with allegations that the father had abandoned him and the mother had neglected him since he was 12 years old by not providing for the necessities for his necessities of life, and therefore he left home to come to the U.S. from Guatemala. Trial court conducted an evidentiary hearing and denied the petition, finding the child did not qualify as dependent and was admittedly being well cared for by an uncle who the court described as ready, willing, and able, and an able relative against whom no allegations of abuse, abandonment, or neglect were made. In the lower court, the petitioner argued that he may be forced to return to Guatemala if the petition weren't granted. And so clearly one of the purposes of filing the petition was to secure SIJ status. Issue was whether under these facts the child was dependent. The court found that the trial court's discretion in child welfare proceedings is very broad. The court's final ruling of dependency is a mixed question of law and fact and will be sustained on review if the trial court applied the correct law. And this ruling is supported by competent substantial evidence. In this case, the appellate court laid out some factors that it says trial courts should use to analyze these private dependency petitions. First of all, the court noted that there's some commonalities amongst all of these petitions, and that usually the child is about to turn 18. The child is abused or abandoned or neglected in their home country, often months or years prior to the filing of the petition. And sometimes the petitions are even accompanied by affidavits from the parents that essentially admit to the wrongful acts. The petitions state that the children are at substantial risk of imminent harm if returned to their home country and that they have no parent or legal guardian to care for them. That was just an observation of the court about fact patterns found in these petitions. And then the factors that the court laid out that the trial court should consider is the nature, severity, and frequency of the abuse, neglect, or abandonment, the time that has lapsed between the abuse, neglect, or abandonment and the filing of the petition, whether or not the child is presently at a continued but not necessarily imminent risk of harm before turning 18 years old, the availability of a caregiver capable of providing supervision and care, and then five, any other relevant factors. Interesting in this case was, contrary to the YV case discussed earlier out of the first district, the trial court in this case found that the uncle qualified as a caregiver because he was entrusted with the child's care according to and pieced together Chapter 3901, Sub 10, and Sub 47. The court found that the Office of Refugee Settlement was the agency that picked up the child following his attempt to illegally cross the border and placed the child with his uncle while the immigration charges remained pending. So In that case, the trial court found that the uncle was the caregiver of the child and that the agency, the Office of Homeland, Office of Refugee Settlement, wasn't the agency that was legally responsible for the child's care. And so in this case, the child was not found to be dependent based on being placed with an uncle. The appellate court also addressed the quote-unquote vexing issue of whether adjudication of dependency can be made based on an allegation of abuse, abandonment, or neglect occurring at any time, even if remote to the time of the filing of the petition. And then the appellate court gives an example that said that if the statute were applied literally, then a 17-year-old could be adjudicated dependent based on abusive acts of a deceased parent that occurred at age 2. So I'm going to go on to the next case. There's also a dissent in that case, the OICL case, that I'll talk about for just a second. In that case, Judge Frost states that the majority opinion recognizes that 390115E can be a basis for the finding of dependency, which is that the child has no legal caregiver, but it fails to recognize an independent basis of dependency and then cites to the YB case. The dissent also is skeptical as to the trial court's finding that the uncle was a legal custodian, because legal custodian in the dissent's view requires a legal status conveyed by a court, not just the child being placed with a relative by the Office of the refugee office. So, sort of a tension there. The next case, and I'm going to start moving through these a little quicker, is the interest of BRCM, a third district case from 2015. Basically the same facts, except for this child was living with a godmother and not a family member. Trial court denied the petition without an evidentiary hearing, but based only on a colloquy between the attorney and the court. Rule out of that case is the purpose of the dependency provisions, Chapter 39, is not to facilitate the pursuit of special juvenile immigrant status, but rather to provide services for children who are truly abandoned. So now a departure. Earlier cases recognized that the legislature authorized dependency courts to be used for this purpose, but now the court's saying that Chapter 39 is not meant for that. And then a second holding out of that case was that although godmother is not expressly included in the enumeration of other persons responsible for a child's welfare, it notes that the statute points to various people that do qualify, but it's not an exhaustive list, so perhaps a godmother could be a legal caregiver. There's a dissent in that case, and basically a dissent saying that there should have been an evidentiary hearing. And more or less, these cases need to be looked at on an individual basis with participation by DCF to come out to the right conclusion. And the dissent also points out that the dependency courts can consider what Congress has invited them to do, but not ordered them to do, which is to determine whether children would be dependent under state law in order to qualify for SIJS status. A more recent case out of 3rd DCA in the interest of SARD, a 2016 case, basically same facts, child private dependency petition, child about to turn 18. Court states now that the dependency statutes were meant to protect children who are the victims of abuse, abandonment, or neglect, and who are in need of intervention by the court and services by the state. The primary goal of the statute is to preserve the family structure, not to provide a gateway to citizenship for children who are entering this country illegally in search of a better life. And Judge Shepherd writes a concurring opinion and he stayed. I'm not sure if Judge Shepard's male or female, so excuse me. The judge states that the opinion of the court today reveals yet a second reason, and one of arguably a higher order, for the affirmance of the trial court's decision in these cases, namely that those who seek to stretch state dependency laws for the sole purpose of obtaining lawful residency as opposed to relief from abuse, abandonment, or neglect are fostering outcomes which are inconsistent with the laws and policies of our national government. States essentially that it's the purview of the federal government to establish immigration laws and that state courts should stay out of it, essentially. So you can see how appellate courts are looking at these petitions more and more skeptically. Another case, this one out of the first DCA this year, child's mother with whom he lived filed a dependency petition alleging the child had been abandoned by his father in their native country of Honduras approximately 12 years prior to the final hearing. So the mother testified that she was willing and able to continue to provide for all of the child's needs, and that the only imminent risk to the child was that he faced the possibility of deportation to return to Honduras. And in this case, the first DCA found that it is possible, of course, for a child to be dependent based only on one parent's actions, but to construe the definition of dependency as including every child living in a single-parent household with adequate support and care and whose second parent is absent would be contrary to the plain meaning of the statute. And further goes on to say that the use of abandonment by one parent in a child's country of origin, which has little if any present effect on the child to support an adjudication of dependency, is a misapplication of the statute, which leads to an absurd result. Last case I've cited to you is from a few months ago out of the third DCA, Henry FJGM. Private dependency petition, child lived with his mother in Miami, father abandoned the child in Honduras. The only thing I would note out of that case is that there's a dissent by Judge Salter in that case where Judge Salter argues that these cases deserve individualized scrutiny and an adjudication of dependency if appropriate as to each parent. So that's sort of the evolution of the state of the law now, and we'll see what the Supremes do.
I think that concludes our presentation. I don't know if there's time for questions or not.
All right. Anybody have any questions? It was a really good and thorough presentation, Eighth Circuit. Thank you, and we appreciate it. Before everybody goes, I want to let you know, in addition, don't forget on our website, we've got a link, we've got a scroll down link from the Training Resources tab to our Child Dependency Practice Manual. And in addition to what you've heard today, there's a summary and a chapter in there on this subject that Liz Gamsky created. Not only does it give you a good, concise reading further for this subject, but also from the Training Resources tab, when you go down to case summaries, you can go to the click on case summary, you can go to the specific link from there for immigration topic, and there's a listing, too, of all the prominent relevant cases that not only you can read summaries to, but also give you a link to the actual opinion. So there you have it for the topic for today, and hope that everybody has a great and safe and happy weekend. Take care.
Thanks.